The top soccer nations of the region compete in North America for the most prestigious prize, the 2015 CONCACAF Gold Cup, here in Canada for the first time. Jamaica versus El Salvador and Canada versus Costa Rica. Tuesday, July 14th, 6 p.m. at BMO Field. Don't miss Jamaica face off against El Salvador, followed by host nation Canada taking on CONCACAF's top-ranked Costa Rica. Tickets start at $25. To purchase, go to goldcup.org.
Welcome to a Monday edition of the Soccer Central Podcast. I'm John Molinaro, Chief Soccer Reporter for Sportsnet. Hope you all had a pleasant weekend and that you're settling in for the week ahead. No James Sharman today, as he's off for family reasons, so I'm going to be flying solo on the podcast. In the second half of the program, I'll be talking to Sportsnet commentator Jerry Dobson, recapping Saturday's UEFA Champions League final that saw Barcelona beat my beloved Juventus 3-1. Before that, though, we're going to talk about the opening weekend of the FIFA Women's World Cup that kicked off in Canada. I'm pleased to welcome to this show Sandra Prusina, broadcaster for 660 News, a Calgary-based radio station owned by Rogers. Sandra writes about women's soccer for a number of websites and has been filing regular reports for sportsnet.ca on the tournament, and will continue to do so until the final on July 6th. Sandra has taken time out of her busy schedule to talk to Soccer Central and joins us on the phone from her office in Calgary. Sandra, how are you?
Very well, John. How's it going?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You were in Edmonton for Canada's 1-0 win over China on Saturday in the opening game of the tournament, a game that saw Christine Sinclair score an injury time penalty for the Reds. Just want to get your general impressions of the Canadian performance. What did you, putting the result aside, obviously that was a positive. What did you make of the way the John Herdman team played on the pitch?
It was a little disjointed, if that's a word that I can use. I thought they came out quite well in the first 20 minutes, considering the magnitude of the game and the fact that they had all these eyeballs on them, 55,000 plus at Commonwealth, and they're hosting this tournament that we've been talking about for the past 4 years. So they played really well. But there was a moment in that first half where China had a free kick and it ricocheted off of both of Canada's posts. And after that point, it's like Canada got scared. Something in terms of the way that they were attacking the ball, it just wasn't working. They were getting a little bit sloppy. We saw some giveaways. And then toward the end of the second half, so when John Herdman made a couple of substitutes, which I think did work in his favor, we saw a bit of a switch in the way that Canada started to play a little bit more aggressive. Again, the finishing was lacking the entire game, but definitely things turned on the up. And then, of course, in the 93rd minute, they finished it off.
It was kind of hard for Canada, I thought. I'm not sure what you think, but it seemed like they were having a very hard time breaking down China, who, let's be honest, they were putting all 11 players behind the ball. Were you surprised how difficult it was for Canada to kind of get that breakthrough?
Well, and it's something that John Herdman had spoken of prior to that opening match. He had said, well, if I'm going to assume the way that China's going to play is they're going to just park the bus, and that's the term that he used. They're going to park the bus, and Canada needed to find a way to break through, and you said it exactly. Canada had a very difficult time. When you have that many players lining up, they're defending so aggressively that you don't really have a way of getting that ball through, and unfortunately, Canada's fullbacks really had to work very, very hard up those flanks, trying to cross in the balls into the 18 just to try and get a forward or a midfielder to get a foot or a head on something, so that just didn't happen. Luckily for Canada, I would say, is with New Zealand coming up in their next match, they're really not going to have to worry about that again in terms of that playing style. I think that's in the past now. And something I found really interesting at the Chinese press conference after the match on Saturday, in no specific terms, but you could kind of read that the Chinese head coach basically said, we were playing for a draw. So I think that's kind of all you needed to know in terms of the way the Chinese were going to come and play this game, and they did. I mean, up to that point, they did.
Right. Obviously, the story of the game or the highlight of the game was Christine Sinclair slotting that penalty deep in injury time to give Canada the win. She took it really well, and the Chinese goalkeeper read it, but she was still able to put it just inside the post. Controversial call, though. I mean, what was your sort of take on the referee rewarding Canada a penalty like that?
I had to watch it a couple of times until I felt that I had a really good look at it, because when it happened right away, I smiled a little bit to myself and I said, wow, this is going to be a storybook ending, but did it need to be that way? And I watched it a few times after the match, and I think that was the right call to make, because you had mentioned earlier the defending of the Chinese, that's what they did. They were very physical, and when you're going to defend in a physical manner and you're basically clotheslining somebody in the penalty box, that's going to get called regardless if it's in the first 5 minutes or if it's an injury time. So I do think it was the right call. Whether or not Adriana Leone went down a little bit easier, I mean, that's a debate and maybe a moot point now, but I do think it was the correct call.
And it's interesting too, because I think Herdman in the post game, he not suggested, but he kind of came out and said that, you know, the big crowd and kind of that sort of helped sort of the referee make the decision. Further to that point, I mean, what, you were there, what was the atmosphere like in Edmonton for the game?
It was incredible. It was just, even leading up to the match, you could really sense this kind of electric atmosphere outside Commonwealth Stadium. People were there 2-3 hours before kickoff, so they were really ready for this. Weather-wise, it was a beautiful day. You could probably see, if you're watching on TV, lots of people with sunburn and stuff because, you know, near 30 degrees, not a lot of clouds in the sky, and everybody was really anticipating something in terms of action on the pitch. They needed a goal, so for it to happen in that 93rd-ish minute, and everybody's on the seat just waiting to explode, and when it happened, it was awesome. But another really poignant moment, I thought, was when the Canadian flag came out, and you could kind of sense people were getting a little misty, and I just thought it was handled so well in terms of the way the anthem was sung by 55,000 people. Really just gives you goosebumps thinking about it when everybody's so patriotic and you see all of that red in the crowd, because the way that Commonwealth is set up, when you look at it without any spectators, it's green and gold. So to see all of that green and gold covered up in terms of everything sitting in red, it was pretty special.
I have to say, from watching here in Toronto, it came across really well on television. Yeah. So, and it was nice to see Edmonton putting on such a great sort of performance and show for the country.
They really did. Yeah. Like, kudos to them. Absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking to Sandra Priscina of 660 News in Calgary here on the Soccer Central podcast. Who stood out for you on an individual basis for Canada versus China? I mean, I think, you know, obviously Sinclair is getting a lot of the attention for the goal, but was there any sort of Canadian players who you thought had really strong games?
I thought the fullbacks did a really good job. Alicia Chapman, to me, this was her, despite her a little bit later in the age in terms of not calling her a rookie, but she is a little bit older. She's not 20. She's 26. She's not like Jesse Fleming or Kadisha Buchanan, but it was her Women's World Cup debut, and she was incredible. Like, she owned that left side of the pitch. She is really physical, but in a way that, you know, she's not going to get the foul. She's going to win those one-versus-one battles, and at the same time, she's really creative. And something I think I had written about for one of the posts on Sportsnet.ca is the fact that John Herdman, for years, since him coming to Canada, he's always searched for this modern fullback, so somebody that can move up and down the pitch while being really creative, also being responsible in their own zone. And I think that's what you have with Alicia. And the nice thing is she does it on the left side. She's a very strong left player, which is something that all coaches, I think, search for, because everybody's so predominant on their right side. And then on the other side, you have Jose Bélanger, who, this is her second start as a right back. She's predominantly played as a forward and as a midfielder throughout her career, also her Women's World Cup debut. And she did well. She did admirably. You're asking a very big task of someone. Someone I wanted to maybe point out is, I realize Lauren Sesselman, I think she did struggle a little bit in the first half, and she made a bit of an error in terms of a soft back pass to Erin McLeod, and Erin had to really clean that up so to avert a crisis. And after that, you could see John Herdman, and you could see him speaking to her and telling her to calm down a little bit, just keep it simple. And after that point, she did. So I did want to give her a bit of props in terms of turning her game around, because you know what? He could have subbed her out at the half. But honestly, he kept her in, and I think that worked in her benefit, because when someone believes in you, and keep in mind, she's coming back from a bad injury. She hasn't played a 90-minute match in over a year. She had been playing 45 and then progressing up to 60 and 70. But to play the 90 minutes and get out of that fairly unscathed is really good for her moving forward in the tournament, I'd say.
Chapman is an interesting story. I remember interviewing her in October after, I can't remember who Canada played a friendly. It was probably the one in Edmonton.
Japan.
Japan, that was it. And, you know, she told me, I kind of found out her backstory about, you know, she was sort of forgotten by Carolina Marace, and she'd been, for lack of a better word, harassing John about, well, yeah, you know, wanting to get a call up, and that she was very close to, you know, possibly she was considering playing for Scotland, and in the end she ended up playing for Canada. It really is quite a remarkable story, and I think you're quite right. I mean, John, the left-sided defense has long been a problem, and she's really sort of made that position her own in a very short period of time.
She really has, and as you mentioned, there were the two friendlies last October. It was one in Edmonton and one in Vancouver, and when she made her debut against Japan, Canada lost 3-0, but she was absolutely the highlight of that match. She was named player of the match, and I remember she was in the press conference post-match, and John spoke about her ravingly, and in the mix zone, I spoke to him on Saturday, and I specifically asked him about his fullbacks, and he was so happy with both of them, and specifically mentioning Alicia and how well she's progressed, ditto for Jose, and he said there are a couple of little things he wants to clean up with them moving on, but he's quite pleased with what he saw.
Belanger, it's an interesting one, too, because I was in the game, I was at the game in Hamilton, the team's final tune-up game against England last week. And that was Belanger's first game at right fullback, and I thought she did quite well. Not nearly as effective against China, but still, I thought, you know, a pretty solid game. Does John sort of stick with her even when Rianne Wilkinson comes back? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
I would think not. I think that is Rianne's spot, regardless of Jose. Jose is meant to be an attacking midfielder or a forward, and right, I think Canada was maybe missing her creativity a little bit higher up top because she is a very skilled player. She's so good with the ball at her feet. And with Rianne, you have someone who has 166 appearances for Canada. She's been through Women's World Cups. She's been through the Olympics. She's also coached a number of these youngsters on the team in terms of the U-20 last year, so she knows this team in and out. Her leadership is incredible, so the second that she can get back on the pitch, I do think that spot is hers because she's been training and working at that spot for the last 10-plus years with this team. So I think if Rianne can slot back in, she will. She has this hamstring injury, and John did mention he'd like to see her get a group stage game, but again, I was watching them warm up, and she wasn't doing a whole lot of warming up yet, on Saturday, so it's really tough to say what will happen there.
When you look at the performance against China as a whole, what do you think the team needs to improve on, and how do they improve on that leading into the next game against New Zealand?
Well, I think the nice thing is you have this game out of the way. Everybody's been talking about this game for the last 3 years, basically, leading up to it, right? And the questions have been ad nauseum, things like, how are you going to react when you see all the red in the stands? How are you going to react when you hear, oh, Canada played? The good thing is that's all done. They don't have to worry about it anymore. And Aaron McLeod had said post-match Saturday that the nerves were absolutely there. So the nerves are gone now. Now you can focus on Thursday and just playing soccer. And there's a lot of cool storylines with Thursday's game, too. I mean, you have John Herdman facing his old team, mm-hmm, the team that he brought to the World Cup in 2011. He grew as a coach under New Zealand, so that's going to be pretty neat. That way Canada can just focus on what they want to do, and they've got a really good crowd in Edmonton. Canada obviously loves playing in Edmonton. They have this special relationship with women's soccer there, so I think they just have to not worry so much about what's happening around them, stick to playing soccer. I think that's the most important thing because they're prepared. You can't say they're not. I think they want to be connected, and they're prepared, and that's what they are.
Next up for Canada is Thursday's game against New Zealand in Edmonton. How do you think the Reds match up against the Kiwis?
I think Canada does have the edge in terms of firepower and their game plan. I think Canada will be able to more adapt to what New Zealand is going to play in their sort of formation. So Canada will be able to do their 4-4-3 likely, or, you know, and play in that kind of symbolism in terms of versus somebody like China where you've got that parking the bus situation, and you can't really penetrate through. So I think Canada will be able to show a little bit more of their creativity. I think the fullbacks will be given a little bit of a break. They'll continue to bring the ball up the pitch and try and cross it in, but this way Canada will be able to, you know, use the middle a little bit, because I think that's something they suffered with against China.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that was most of what they were creating was certainly down the flanks, and it was very little down the middle. So it'll be interesting to see. I quite agree with you. I think they'll have more opportunity to show off their, not necessarily create a flair, but just be able to create more, and certainly down the middle against New Zealand.
Yeah.
Listen, Sandra, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Keep up the great work, and we'll hope to have you back on the show soon enough.
Thank you so much for having me, John. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Sandra. That's Sandra Prusina of 660 News in Calgary. We're going to talk a little UEFA Champions League now with Sportsnet soccer commentator Jerry Dobson. I would call him the hardest working man at Sportsnet, but that's not the case. Jerry, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. I'm not working that hard today, so
see?
I guess you can't call me the hardest working
that's
guy.
Why I didn't say it. That's why I didn't say it. First of all, I wanted to get your sort of general impressions on the game on Saturday. Barcelona claiming its fifth UEFA Champions League title, courtesy of a 3-1 win over Juventus in Berlin. What did you think of the game overall?
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I was in the camp that was worried that it would be a Barcelona rout. All, you know, with all due respect to Juventus, or a very good, well-organized defensive team, I think there's probably maybe just a little bit of an element of doubt in everybody's mind that they could cause Barcelona too much trouble. And we were worried, or I was worried anyway, that it would be a blowout. Obviously, it didn't turn out that way, and it turned out to be a really good game. I mean, you had to feel for Juventus and some of their senior players. You know, probably the last kick at it for Buffon. I mean, he may still play for a couple more years, but it's hard to get back to the final. So, had to feel for them, but it was a good game. The better team won, and I think that's about all you can ask for.
It's an interesting point you raise about, because I had the same fear, it being this was going to be a blowout, and especially when Rakitic scored in the fourth minute, I thought, oh God, here we go, because they absolutely, that 16 pass sequence that they put together before Rakitic slotted home, I mean, that was vintage Barcelona. And I certainly thought that, oh God, they're going to be off at the races. But it didn't sort of turn out that way. I mean, Juventus more than held their own. And I would suggest, you know, they kind of bossed it for a little bit there, didn't they?
They did. You know, once they settled down, you're right, Barcelona came out firing on all cylinders. But after that goal was scored, like you say, we all thought, uh-oh, look out. If they get one more now, it's lights out. It could end up being 5 or 6. But to Juventus's credit, they dug in, they settled in, and they did force the issue and came back. And towards the end of the last, I would say, 15 to 20 minutes of that first half, they were probably the better team. And so it made us all wonder, okay, what's going to happen now in the second half? What kind of changes will Enrique make, or what kind of changes will Juventus make and could make for an interesting second half? And it did make for an interesting second half. But a lot of credit goes to Juventus, because they could have pulled it up with that relentless pressure that never really materialized. They were able to hold it off.
Yeah, I think you're right. And further to that, it's interesting because, not that he hadn't necessarily had a bad game, he didn't, but, you know, Messi did set up the Luis Suarez winning goal. But I would suggest he didn't dominate like he normally does. I mean, this wasn't, I don't think you would rank this among his best performances. Did that surprise you at all? I mean, how did Juventus sort of relatively contain him, do you think?
Well, that's, you know, when you talk about it not being one of his better performances, I think that's where, you know, you have to, like you say, give credit to Juventus. They were so organized defensively, and even with Chiellini out, I mean, they were still strong at the back, you know, Bonucci and Barzagli and all, I mean, they're good defenders, let's face it.
Sure.
And they held their own, and they were just able to stymie those guys. And I guess we all did think, on one hand, going into that game, if as soon as we knew what the matchup was going to be, well, I guess if there's any team that has a chance of stopping Barcelona, it is Juventus, and they nearly did. So I don't know if I'm all that surprised that Messi didn't, you know, dominate and score 2 or 3 goals himself. It was certainly going to be a possibility, but I'm not surprised up against Juventus and how good they are.
We're talking to Sportsnet commentator Jerry Dobson here on the Soccer Central podcast. Where does this particular Barcelona team rank, do you think, in the annals of history? I mean, this is a deadly trio in Neymar, Messi, and Suarez, who had, I think, 120 goals ahead of the ahead of Saturday's game. They certainly look like they're set up to, you know, for future success. when you think about this Barcelona teams, where do you think they rank it?
Well, they got to rank up there pretty high, obviously, with those three guys and all the goals that they scored. They won the treble, and they played so well in La Liga with all the goals they scored there and the number of goals that they didn't concede. I think, what did they concede? 21 goals.
21, yeah.
It was outrageous how many goals they conceded this year in winning La Liga, winning the Domestic Cup, and winning the Champions League in fine style. So I think it has to rank up there with one of the greatest teams, one of the greatest Champions League teams that we have seen, and maybe one of the greatest Barcelona teams as well. I don't see how you couldn't.
No, I would agree. I mean, and when you think about their core of Messi, Neymar, and Suarez, they're all in their 20s. So this is, like I said, I think this could be a team that's set up for future success beyond this season.
You know what I find interesting, too, when you look at them man for man and the way they set up, and then you look at the goalkeeping situation.
Right.
Ter Stegen playing all the cup games and the Champions League games, he did not play a single league game this season. And he played every Champions League game.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've ever seen anything like that and if we ever will. And on the other hand, the other guy, Claudio Bravo, he didn't play a single Champions League game, and he played all but one of the La Liga games. And it was the third string goalkeeper who played the other one. I don't think I've ever seen a goalkeeping situation like that on a championship team before. Very odd.
Yeah, it was
footnote, I guess.
Yeah, but perhaps. Yeah, it was very weird. I mean, we've kind of seen sort of remnants of that before where, you know, a coach will sort of rotate between his goalkeepers. But on a team like this and to this extent,
right.
I mean, it really was kind of startling.
Well, and when you see that Ter Stegen, he's got a Champions League medal because he's played every single game, but he didn't play a game in the league.
Yeah.
Not one game in the league. Like, I don't know what kind of a feeling that would be for a player on a team like that. You know, when it's all said and done, okay, I won the Champions League, but we won La Liga, but I didn't contribute one iota to La Liga. It's just an odd one. But
speaking of
footnotes to history,
yeah, exactly. Speaking of goalkeepers, and you touched on it briefly there, I think one of the stories here, and a lot of people were kind of rooting for on a personal level, was Gianluigi Buffon, such a long time servant of Juventus, remained with the team when they were relegated to Serie B, where he could have went anywhere in the world. He's got everything on his resume except a Champions League. I mean, this was a pretty disappointing result for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the most disappointing thing for me, is that Buffon, at his age now, I think he's 37, 39, I'm not sure, but at his age, I mean, he can probably still play a couple more years.
Oh, sure,
yeah. But to get back, it's hard enough to get to the Champions League final, let alone win it. And the career that he's had, he'll go down in history as one of the greatest goalkeepers of all time, and yet he's very likely not going to win the Champions League. But that's the way sports goes, if I can digress for a moment, John, because I've always got this baseball story in the back of my mind, because there was one of the greatest hitters of all time in Major League Baseball was Ted Williams. I mean, he is, among baseball circles, he is it. He is the greatest hitter of all time. His team got to the World Series in 1946, which was one of his first years in the major leagues. They lost, and everybody kept telling him, don't worry about it. You'll get back there. Your team is too good. You're too good. You'll get back to the World Series. Well, he played until 1960, and his team never even got to the World Series again. So he played another 15 years in the major leagues, and they never got back to the World Series. And that kind of thing holds true across all sports. I mean, as you've got to take the moment when you have it, because you may never get that chance again, and it may be said all said and done for Buffon. He may never get back there.
No, it's a good point. And sort of on the other side of the ledger, you look at a guy like Xavi, who was playing his last game for Barcelona.
He won everything.
Added another cup. Not a bad way to end a 17-year run at Barcelona, eh?
Yeah, there's nothing that he hasn't won. He's won, you know, he's won league titles. He's won Champions League, World Cups, Domestic Cups. He has won everything, and then he caps it off by coming on and setting the all-time record for most appearances ever in the Champions League. So he might as well just go to heaven right now, because what else is there after that, right?
It was a nice moment, too, when he was subbed into the game, because he was coming in for Andrés Iniesta, and they kind of shared like a nice moment, and you really can't sort of think about or even mention one without the other. They're just so tied at the hip, aren't they?
Yeah, oh, for sure. There's no question, and there was moments like that, and kind of serendipitous little moments at the end of that game, and that's certainly one of them where it's just sort of tied it all up in a nice little bow, didn't it?
It was nice to see Xavi afterwards kind of consoling Pirlo, who was, you know, I think he was crying, so that was a nice moment too.
Now, I don't feel as badly for Pirlo because Pirlo has won the thing.
No, absolutely, sure.
So,
no question.
It won't hurt as bad or as long for him as it will for Buffon, I don't think, but it was very touching, you're right.
Right. For people who don't know, Sportsnet contract air, the Champions League has expired, and starting next season, our friends at TSN are going to take over the broadcast rights. I thought it was a very classy thing you did at the end of Saturday's broadcast when you wished TSN the very best. You've been covering the UEFA Champions League for a long time during your time at Sportsnet. You've watched a lot of great games and moments. What makes this so special? What makes this one of – what makes the Champions League the Champions League? Why are we so enthralled with it, do you think?
Well, you know what? I think, John, that maybe the number one reason is those of us that cover the sport on a regular basis, I think we all know and understand – how important it is to all the players. And when you realize that it's that important to all the players, it's important because that's the pinnacle of club football for those players. They play and are paid by their clubs. They're professionals with their clubs. Yes, there's international duty, but that's a completely separate thing. But this is where their bread and butter is. This is where they live. This is where they work. These are their teammates day in and day out. And this is the epitome of championship football. And when you know that the players want it that badly, and when you see the reactions after the game of the winning side and the losing side, you know just what it means. And I think when we understand how much it means to them, it just reinforces for us the level of importance of this competition and how fantastic it is.
No, you're right. And I guess that sort of helps you in your job over the years in terms of communicating that to the audience and getting wrapped up all in it, I would say, too, right?
Yeah, there's no question. When it's all on the line and there are big moments and there are big games, it gets us all revved up as well because we enjoy being part of these big championships and these big moments. That's what we remember about our careers as well.
Right. Well, I have to say, I thought you and Craig and James and Danny Dicchio, you all did a fantastic job this season, and it was a great way to go out, and you've done a fantastic job over the years covering this. And
well, it's been a lot of fun over the years. I mean, these things come and go in terms of sports broadcast rights. You know, you win some and you lose some, and best of luck to TSN over the next few years when they take over. But we certainly have enjoyed the ride over the years. It's been a lot of fun, and we would like to think that we elevated the product as well, showing as many games as we did on each and every match day right through the season.
No, I don't think there's any question about that, Jerry. You guys should be very proud of the job you did. Listen, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and I'll see you around the office soon.
You bet. Take care, John. Thanks a lot.
That was Jerry Dobson, chief soccer commentator for Sportsnet. That's it for the show this week. Just a reminder that you can go to sportsnet.ca for in-depth coverage of the FIFA Women's World Cup. We have a special section of the website.